from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This morning, the U.S. Supreme Court heard Hamdi v. Rumsfeld and Rumsfeld v. Padilla. The court must decide whether the U.S. government can indefinitely detain American citizens as unlawful enemy combatants without bringing charges or even allowing them access to legal representation. Yasser Hamdi was born in Louisiana, grew up in Saudi Arabia, and was caught in Afghanistan, allegedly fighting for the Taliban in November 2001. Jose Padilla was born in Brooklyn, raised in Chicago, and introduced to Islam by his Taco Bell manager in Florida. He moved to Cairo in 1998 to teach English and from there traveled the Middle East. He first caught the attention of the U.S. government when an al-Qaeda official allegedly claimed under interrogation that Padilla was involved in a dirty bomb plot. Padilla was arrested at O'Hare Airport in Chicago on a trip to visit his family in May last year. Tonight on Point, fundamental issues of civil liberty and war, the two cases in front of the Supreme Court, and whether the White House has gone too far or taken necessary steps to protect the United States. Has the U.S. government gone too far in these detentions? Are you unnerved to see these U.S. citizens in prison indefinitely, or are you comforted? Should citizenship guarantee full access to U.S. courts, even if a citizen is allegedly fighting against the United States? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin with a wrap-up of this morning's arguments before the nine justices. Emily Bazelon is senior editor at Legal Affairs Magazine and a visiting lecturer at Yale Law School. She was at the Supreme Court this morning and joins me now from New Haven, Connecticut. Good evening and welcome, Emily Bazelon.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you with us. Emily, I want to get a taste of what you heard this morning and others. Let's start, if you join me, with a clip from the Jose Padilla case. And here, Paul Clement, the Deputy Solicitor General, argues the government's case in front of the justices.
There is a unique interest, especially in the course of this conflict, where intelligence is at an unprecedented value, to have some ability with some detainees to deal with them in a way that allows us to get intelligence to prevent future terrorist attacks and not be limited just to going after them retrospectively for past terrorist attacks.
Now let's listen to Jose Padilla's lawyer, Jennifer Martinez. Here she argues that the government is asking for limitless power.
The government asks in this case for basically limitless power. And however grave the circumstances of the war on terror may be, this nation has faced other grave threats. We've had war on our soil before, and never before in the nation's history has this court granted the president a blank check to do whatever he wants to American citizens.
Voices from the chambers of the Supreme Court this morning. Emily Bazelon, you were there. Two cases here heard back to back this morning. What were the primary issues that came to the fore as the justices questioned those before them?
Well, it was a terrific argument this morning. It's the court's last day of argument of the term, and it really felt like a grand finale. The key issue, the government is asking the court to keep on the sidelines of the war on terror in the same way as the justices would stay out of any other war. No one thinks that it makes sense for courts to start interfering on the battlefield. And the question is whether the nature of al-Qaeda and the reality of 9/11 means that the lines of the battlefield are now very hard to draw. And this case is about who gets to draw those lines.
What is the power that the government is asking the justices to endorse?
The government wants the power to detain people indefinitely, and it wants to be able to make its own determinations about who those people should be, where they can be held, and for how long, and under what circumstances. In particular, the government is nervous about its detainees having access to counsel. As Robert Clement's remarks made clear, the idea is that information getting is much easier when witnesses, detainees, can be held in detention for a long time. They can become not so that anything bad will be done to them, but because that will enable the government to curry sympathy with them and to really work with them to gather information.
So you're saying the government doesn't want an attorney at the detainee's side or with access to the detainee because they can interrogate the detainee or break down their defenses more effectively without that legal representation around?
Exactly. the government has given access to lawyers for both Hamdi and Padilla, but that access is very recent, and it's not the sort of access to lawyers that normal criminal due process would allow for. The lawyers are being observed while they're talking to their clients, and everything that's being said is videotaped.
But they're asking for enormous powers here. What did the attorneys representing Hamdi and Padilla have to say?
The attorneys for Hamdi and Padilla are concerned that there is no check on the government's power. And this is a particularly potent argument in Padilla's case. Padilla is a United States citizen. He was in this country when he was captured. And he has been accused of associating with al-Qaeda, but he has not been charged with any particular wrongdoing, and the government has not been specific in its accusations against him.
I want to clarify Yasser Hamdi's status. Is he a U.S. citizen? He was born in the United States, I understand.
I believe that he is a citizen. He was born in the United States. He was captured in Afghanistan, the government says, on the battlefield holding a weapon. And from the government's point of view, Yasser Hamdi should be treated the same as any prisoner of war, anyone who's captured in the heat of battle. And the government wants the military to be able to interrogate people caught in those circumstances, including Yasser Hamdi, in whatever way the military thinks is useful.
What did the Supreme Court justices' questions indicate they are most focused on in these cases this morning?
Well, it felt like a very close argument with some different points of view. Scalia and Rehnquist strongly suggested that in their minds, none of this is really the business of the courts to be deciding. Hamdi, who was caught in Afghanistan with a weapon, is not Scalia's idea of a detainee we need to be concerned about. He really looks to Scalia like your run-of-the-mill enemy soldier. And that's the kind of person the military has always gotten to decide how to question.
Even if they're a United States citizen?
Yes.
Okay.
At least there's an argument to be made that that's the case based
All right.
on
and
past
the,
cases.
And the Padilla case arrested at O'Hare?
The Padilla case, still to Scalia, this is not a concern because he is very willing to have the government decide the enemy combatant status of Padilla. And again, once you buy into the idea that Padilla is an enemy combatant captured after a war has begun and before it has ended on the battlefield, then he is also a traditional prisoner of war. And, you know, obviously the most controversial part of that sort of four-square box I laid out is the idea that the theater of war is everywhere. It's in the United States. It's anywhere where the government needs to fight al-Qaeda.
And which justices – so Scalia and Rehnquist appearing sympathetic to the government argument, what about the other side?
Well, Justice Ginsburg seemed the least concerned about the problems of courts reviewing the merits of a military detention. She kept asking both sides questions about what had been done in other wars to make sure that detentions were fair. And to her, this seemed to be not just an issue of rights accorded to citizens under American law, but a fundamental question of due process for all. Torture is not at issue in either of these cases, but Ginsburg repeatedly asked the government why their theory wouldn't allow it to torture someone.
Yes, please.
I was going to add that Justice Breyer also strongly suggested that the courts have an ongoing role in determining whether in each individual case he is in fact an enemy combatant. And he kept invoking the line of Western legal thought that began, he said, with the Magna Carta and extended to the American Constitution.
So the government not even wanting the courts to be involved at all, even in reviewing the cases, clearly. Do you have a sense of how the court is lining up here, how this ruling may go?
Well, as is often the case, there is a center of the court that seemed to really be wrestling with the limits of these arguments and perhaps looking for a middle ground. Justice Souter's question suggested that he thought that President Bush had lost his congressional backing for this sort of indefinite detention and needed to go back for more. He kept saying, okay, let's assume that the president was given the power to detain immediately after September 11th. Why does he still have it now?
Mm-hmm.
And then we had Justice O'Connor, who seemed very concerned about the prospect that the president's power to detain people against the backdrop of the war on terror could continue indefinitely. And she wanted to know why, if the war on terror lasted for 25 years or for 50 years, how we could be sure that the government's powers wouldn't just continue forever.
Does this tote up to a clear leaning one way or the other then by the court or not?
No, I think not. I think it's going to be a really hard case to call. There are probably 7 votes accounted for, 4 against the government, perhaps, if Justice Souter's vote is secure, and 3 against. I think that Justice O'Connor and Justice Kennedy's votes are fairly up for grabs, at least given their remarks at oral argument.
Emily Bazelon, thanks for that report. I hope you'll stand by now. I want to welcome into our conversation tonight to broaden our discussion. With me in the studio, Anthony Lewis, a longtime columnist for the New York Times, 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner, author of Make No Law, The Sullivan Case and the First Amendment. Anthony Lewis, wonderful to have you tonight, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
I understand you were also in the court this morning in Washington.
I was.
And joining us tonight from New Haven, Connecticut, Andrew McCarthy, former federal prosecutor who led the 1995 terrorism case against Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, also known as the Blind Sheikh, who was convicted in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Anthony McCarthy is a consultant at the Investigative Project in Washington, which gathers intelligence on militant Islamic activities. He's a frequent contributor to the National Review magazine. Good evening and welcome, Andrew McCarthy.
Good evening. Thank you for inviting me.
It's wonderful to have you. Thank you very much for being with us. Anthony Lewis, first to you. You have written with some alarm lately about the Bush administration's approach to civil liberties, saying that they are undermining the very foundation of democracy. What did you hear in the arguments this morning?
I heard a quite undecided Supreme Court. Emily Bazelon did not mention what is not very easy to describe to a radio audience or any audience, mm-hmm. which is that the court was urged by the government, by Paul Clement, to decide the Padilla case not on the issues that we've been talking about or you've been talking about, but on a jurisdictional question, a sort of preliminary question. And the government argues that Padilla's lawyer sued the wrong person. The defendant they chose in the habeas corpus action was Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. The government says they should have had the commander of the brig in South Carolina where he's being held. And if the court decides that is the right man to sue and they sued the wrong man, well, the case is out the window and we don't get an answer to these profound questions.
Is there a chance of that happening?
Absolutely.
Really? So the whole thing may just be left up in the air? The court... I don't know court history well enough to know if they could walk away from such a profound issue on such a technicality.
Oh, they can walk away from any issue they want to. That's they decide.
I guess so. Andrew McCarthy, as you listened to the arguments and questions this morning, how do you see the battlefield here?
What struck me the most, I would say, is the sort of divide between the concern expressed by the Enemy Combatants Council, which is really an abstraction versus the reality on the ground. I think they'd have a much more persuasive case if we were in a technical state of war or if after almost 3 years of what's been called the war on terror in the population of 300 million people, we had actually scooped up more than 3 enemy combatants. My sense of it is that this is an area where it's very appropriate to scrutinize what the government is doing, but it also calls for a sensible interpretation, a sensible sense of how measured really what's happened has been if you look at it in the long view.
So you're saying the government's actually been restrained. Tony Lewis is saying we've got sort of a fundamental undermining of the foundation of democracy here. That's a big gulf.
That's a big gulf.
Well, we've got to take a short break. We're going to come back and hear some of the arguments from this morning, hear more from my guests, Anthony Lewis, Andrew McCarthy, and Emily Bazelon. You can join this conversation as well. Has the United States government gone too far in these detentions or simply done what's necessary to protect all Americans? Are you unnerved to see these U.S. citizens in prison indefinitely without charge? or are you comforted? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the disputed authority of the White House to detain U.S. citizens indefinitely without charges in the war on terror. Two cases before the Supreme Court this morning in Washington. With me tonight in the studio, Anthony Lewis, longtime columnist for the New York Times, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. With us from New Haven, Connecticut, Andrew McCarthy, former federal prosecutor and consultant about militant Islamic activities in the United States. And with us from New Haven, Connecticut as well, Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Legal Affairs Magazine. You can join this conversation tonight. Should citizenship guarantee full access to the courts, even if a citizen is allegedly fighting against the United States? How can you be sure these men were fighting against the United States if they do not have a full and open trial? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have some clips from today's arguments. I want to listen to one together here, if we could, just to kick this off. Here is Justice Stephen Breyer with Paul Clement, Deputy Solicitor General, arguing the government's case. Justice Breyer here asked Clement how long it's all right for the government to hold a prisoner like Hamdi. You'll hear Justice Souter chime in as well.
If you're holding people without a lawyer, with the only neutral decision maker being an interrogator, with no opportunity to present proofs and evidence, with no opportunity to hear the other side, in your opinion, if that goes on and on, let's say it's the Hundred Years' War, is there no opportunity for a court, in your view, to say that this violates for an American citizen the elementary due process that the Constitution guarantees?
Well, as I indicated earlier, Justice Breyer, the courts remain open. We recognize the viability of the writ of habeas corpus. There certainly is a challenge that could be brought to the length of the detention at some point. And the courts would be open to hear claims.
No, but your answer to Justice O'Connor, I thought, was we don't have to worry, or a court should not be worrying, about the indefiniteness of the time, because it may well be that the President or Congress will at some point say the war in Afghanistan is no longer a matter of concern and therefore we don't have to hold the Hamdis. I think that's the only answer that you have given so far to Justice Breyer's question and to Justice O'Connor's question. Am I wrong?
Well, Justice Souter, a couple of points. One is, I mean, I don't think there's any contradiction with that in my answer to Justice Breyer's question. I mean, you can imagine a situation where the evidence and the government's own affidavit shows that somebody's only detained with regard to a war in Afghanistan. And then you could imagine that that has been signed, sealed, and delivered. It's over. The President says so. Congress says so. And there's an effort to continue to detain
that
individual.
Well, I can imagine it, and I can also imagine that concern about Afghanistan will go on as long as there is concern about al-Qaeda, and there is no endpoint that we can see at this point to that. So that it seems to me your answer boils down to saying, don't worry about the timing question. We'll tell you when it's over.
Justice Souter, Justice Breyer, and Deputy Solicitor General Paul Clement today in the Supreme Court chambers. Anthony Lewis, you heard it all this morning in Washington. What is fundamentally at stake in these cases?
Power of the president. The claim here is that a statute passed by Congress, claim of the government, after 9/11, a week after, which authorized the use of force when necessary and appropriate against terrorism, that use of force can include jailing American citizens without trial, without counsel, forever, in solitary confinement.
Because it creates a war situation, a war authorization?
Well, they're treating it as an authorization. Government claims it's an authorization for this kind of action against citizens. And alternatively, the government said, if the statute doesn't cover it, well, we can do it anyway because the president has that power in wartime. Of course, it's only President Bush who has called this a war, legally speaking. Mm-hmm. There's no declaration of war. And to me, the notion that the president can pick someone out and say, you're an enemy combatant. Mind you, everything that was said about Padilla and Hamdi today is only an allegation. There has never been any kind of proceeding in which they had an opportunity to challenge the charge. Mm-hmm. No neutral decider, as Justice Breyer put it. And to me, Mr. McCarthy called this an abstraction. Well, I think if Mr. McCarthy was suddenly told that he was heading for a brig in South Carolina and would remain there for, let's just say, the time that Padilla and Hamdi have already spent, about 2 years, mm-hmm. and he wouldn't be able to see his family or talk to anyone except his interrogators and would be in solitary confinement, no lawyer, and for 2 years, and endlessly, maybe for another 25, I don't think he would regard that as an abstraction.
Andrew McCarthy, clearly there are large stakes here and there are threats here, but doesn't this whole dynamic put American citizens at risk of arbitrary arrest and detention for a very, very long time?
I would say that it did, and I'd be a lot more worried about it if more than 3 out of 300 million had been scooped up and if there hadn't been very colorable, articulable reasons for concluding that these two that we're talking about today, at least, are enemy combatants. I'm not unconcerned about the things that that Mr. Lewis raises. I think that they're important concerns. But I also think that there's a real live reality out there that's not focused on enough. This is not just a technical state of war. This is a shooting war. We're having, in two theaters of battle, soldiers killed regularly. I don't want to try to put a number on it. Only 2 days ago, a spokesman for al-Qaeda promised that in 2004, the attacks against the United States that have taken place in the past would be dwarfed by what they have planned in the here and now.
But let me ask you, if the Supreme Court should rule in the government's favor here, in principle, does not that then open the way for the government? Yes, this time it's three, as you point out, but could it not be 30 or 300 or 3,000 at some future time if the court rules in principle in favor of the government?
The world doesn't exist. America doesn't exist in the vacuum of this one narrow question. The public watches. Congress watches. There's all kinds of checks, political and otherwise, on the president's ability to act. Up till now, he's acted in a very measured way. There's no reason to suspect that if the Supreme Court decides the case in favor of the government, that will then be taken to be licensed to scoop up, tens, thousands, or tens of thousands of people.
Anthony Lewis, how about it? Would it, could it amount to a license for a much more broad-scale dragnet of American citizens? Does it matter if it's 3 or 3,000?
I have no way of predicting whether it'll be 3,000, as you say. But the way we protect civil liberties in this country is to draw the line at the first violation, because otherwise it is an invitation to a president to use that power in a way that is not fair. I just want to give an example from today's argument. It's almost an absurd example, but it was very telling to me. Mm. Justice Stevens, John Paul Stevens, asked counsel for Hamdi, Frank Dunham, whether he, Mr. Dunham, challenged the government's assertions about Hamdi's conduct, challenged the charge that he was an enemy combatant. And Dunham said he did have a substantial dispute with the charge, but then he said that when he went to visit Hamdi, as he did, Hamdi had a lot to say on that subject, but he, Dunham, could not tell the court what it was because what Hamdi said was immediately classified.
So here's the attorney who says...
So Hamdi's defense of himself is now a secret. That's an example of the, to me, abuse that's going on here. Why ever should it be secret?
And yet, raised also today by Justice Scalia was the issue of, in Afghanistan, for example, you had a shooting war going on. If someone's picked up, how is the government supposed to track down the evidence, if they're going to the regular justice system, that they are, in fact, breaking law here, threatening the United States? Let's listen to just a little bit of that. This is the Frank Dunham, the attorney you mentioned for Yasser Hamdi, and Justice Antonin Scalia.
What would you expect the military to do? As I understand it, he wasn't even captured by our own forces. He was captured by Allied forces and turned over to our forces.
Well, that's certainly right? Part of the problem, Your Honor. We have
you want them to run down the members of the Afghan allies who captured this man and get them to testify in a proceeding? Now, it's just putting unreasonable demands upon a war situation.
Your Honor, I don't. My view is that it can never be an unreasonable demand to comply with the habeas corpus and the Fifth Amendment.
Emily Bazelon, how did the court receive that argument that it can never be an unreasonable demand, in this case, even on a shooting battlefield in Afghanistan, I guess, for the government to comply with habeas corpus and the Fifth Amendment?
I don't think the court is sure about what to do with that argument. And, you know, one really interesting question in this case is why does the president need these special powers in wartime? Justice Scalia was talking about a particular situation, but in Padilla, we're really broadening the question so that the issue is whether the theater of war is everywhere. And then you have this question of where to draw boundaries. Are the president's special wartime powers about strengthening his hand to fight al-Qaeda, or are they, as they've historically been, a recognition of a moment where courts may not be up and running? And if the real concern is the latter, then that's not really a situation that we have right now.
You don't have because these two are not even before the courts? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm sorry, because our courts are up and running. Our courts are ready for business in a way that might not have been the case for particular periods during the Civil War, for example.
Oh, I see. If the entire society was disrupted and the courts weren't even working. Andrew McCarthy, what about Tony Lewis's concern here that the way we traditionally police the application of the Constitution is by looking at the first instance, not the 30th or the 3,000th?
I think Anthony Lewis is entirely correct if we're looking at a criminal justice problem. And the questioning that by Justice Scalia that you played a few moments ago points out an important distinction here. And that is the paradigm that we are in connection with the war on terror is not a criminal justice law enforcement issue. It's a national security issue. The invocation of executive power here is not the law enforcement power. We're not in the paradigm where we have a defendant who's presumed innocent, who presumptively has privacy rights, et cetera. We're instead in the national security paradigm where in order to secure the very liberties that Mr. Lewis is so appropriately concerned about, the nation has to survive. And we're not in the place where the person who's in the government sights enjoys the types of presumptions that he would if the law enforcement criminal justice paradigm was the field of play.
Though Justice Stephen Breyer brought this up in a way this morning, questioning Paul Clement again, the Deputy Solicitor General. Let's listen to a clip here where Justice Breyer asked Clement what the difference is between Padilla and any number of dangerous criminals that the courts do deal with every day.
A person has come to the United States. He's, according to the government, committed a serious crime and is dangerous. Well, those are people we deal with all the time in the criminal process. So if you're even assuming this resolution authorizes some kind of force, why isn't the appropriate force where he's in the United States and the courts are open what we would call ordinary criminal process? I mean, that harmonizes everything. Now, maybe there is an answer to that in your vision. I want to find out your vision of what's supposed to happen here and why.
Well, Justice Breyer, let me give you a practical reason, answer, and a legal reason. You may prefer the former. But I think that the practical reason is if you capture somebody who is not just somebody who's guilty of a war crime or a violation of some provision of Title 18, but also has a wealth of information that could be used to prevent future terrorist attacks, then it seems to me that the military ought to have the option of proceeding with him in a way that allows him to get actionable intelligence to prevent future terrorist attacks, and should not be forced into a choice where the only way they can proceed is to proceed retrospectively to try to punish him for past acts. And doing so, whether it's in a military commission or in Article 3, requires you to give him a counsel who likely is going to say that you shouldn't talk to the government about any of these things.
Anthony Lewis, Andrew McCarthy says it's not a criminal justice paradigm here. It's a national security paradigm. That is different.
Yes, it's different if you accept that is the paradigm. I don't minimize or discard as cheap the concern for intelligence. That was Paul Clement's answer, and I thought it was a very good answer. Mm-hmm. We need to talk. Question these people. But for how long? That was the other thing that you played earlier. Mm-hmm. Justice O'Connor and Justice Breyer said, well, you know, for how long? 25 years? 100 years? Mm-hmm. It seems to me very doubtful that after 2 years or 3 years, Hamdi nearly 3 years, they would even conceivably have any remotely valuable intelligence.
It hasn't been squeezed out already.
If it hasn't been squeezed out already. And, you know, Justice Breyer was saying, the part you didn't play of his question.
Yes.
He said, what you did play, why isn't the ordinary criminal process good enough? But mm-hmm. he said, if there's an exception, mm-hmm. if it's a real emergency, then tell us and that'll be an exception. But don't make everything the exception. So you treat anybody who you suspect of having a connection with al-Qaeda as not entitled to an ordinary criminal trial with all the rights that go with it.
Meaning, let's keep the criminal justice system informed in the loop here.
Exactly.
Let's take a few calls. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Howard is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Howard. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'm unnerved by this because of what President Bush and his administration is arguing, because a little over a year ago they were arguing that in Iraq there were weapons of mass destruction, and they were, you know, saying, you know, take our word for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, you know, not in a position or not willing at this point to take their word that somebody, just because they say so, is an enemy combatant and can be held in isolation. Congress had a responsibility to, you know, question the president about his reasons for going to war, you know, to sort of act as a balance against
right.
his. And I think in this case, the courts should be in, you know, should be in a position to do the same thing in regards to this legal issue.
Howard, thank you for raising it. Andrew McCarthy, what about it? Doesn't this put American citizens in the position of having to absolutely and totally trust the executive here, to only pick up the right people and to treat them right, totally outside of public view? Do they deserve that level of, you know, unoverseen discretion, even in duress?
The answer to that is yes. And I think the reason is, you know, look, all administrations make mistakes, all of them, I don't know that the final answer is in on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq or not, but George Bush and this executive branch remains the president with the full panoply of powers of that office. His exercise—
Powers don't necessarily equate with trust at all moments, as you can hear in this call.
Whether or not they do, the one or even a faction of the citizenry's level of trust in the president may call for a variety of things, including, you know, increased congressional scrutiny, et cetera, but it can't hamstring the constitutional executive powers that we rely on, particularly in wartime.
Tony Lewis, quick comment.
I just want to say that Howard put his finger on something there. Toward the end of the argument, Jennifer Martinez, representing Padilla, said that Mr. Clement, her opponent, sounded very reasonable, but what he was really saying was, trust us.
Trust us. It's a lot to ask when citizens are in the brig indefinitely, but the president says there's a war on. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We will be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the disputed authority of the White House to detain U.S. citizens indefinitely without charges in the war on terror. I'm joined tonight from New Haven, Connecticut, by Andrew McCarthy, former federal prosecutor and frequent contributor to the National Review magazine. With me in the studio tonight, Anthony Lewis, longtime columnist for the New York Times, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, and also from New Haven, Connecticut, Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Legal Affairs Magazine. You can join this conversation as well. Can indefinite imprisonment without charge possibly square with American justice? What about innocent until proven guilty? Can that really not apply here? On the other hand, can the Supreme Court know what's ultimately better for American security and liberty than the White House? What is at stake here? For American national security? For American civil liberties? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to hear one more bit from the conversations in the Supreme Court this morning. Here's Justice Scalia and Paul Clement, the Deputy Solicitor General representing the government. Justice Scalia here expressing skepticism that an authorization of war gives the government a free hand in detentions.
I understand the commander-in-chief power to be a power over the military forces when they're being used as military forces, the General Washington power to, you know, to command the forces tactically and everything else. It doesn't mean that he has power to do whatever it takes to win the war. I mean, the steel seizure case demonstrates that well enough. And well, how does this come within, you know, George Washington's commander-in-chief power, which is what I read this congressional resolution to be directed at? Well, it doesn't say you can do whatever it takes to win the war.
No, but Justice Scalia, presumably the authorization of force is read against prior history and this Court's precedents. And those precedents include the Kieran case, where it is absolutely clear that in fighting a war, you have the authority to detain individuals, even if they're not formal military officers, who are affiliated with the enemy and come into the United States intent on committing hostile and warlike acts.
There's another facet of the argument today. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to invite them in. Martin is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Martin. You're on the air.
Hello. My point is the following. When I receive the passport to travel overseas, it comes with some terms and conditions, and one of which is that do not join the armed forces of another country or you can lose your citizenship. So all of this is prefaced with, these are American citizens. Are they still American citizens?
You're suggesting that they joined a foreign force and so they are not. But who's to say that they actually did that in the absence of a trial? With the threat of terrorism, are you willing to accept that on the White House's say-so, Martin?
Well, no, I'm not, but I think that this is a point, and it probably should be argued, but the big distinction is being made here that these people are American citizens,
right.
And I think that's in question.
Well, let us pick it up, Martin. Thank you for your call. Anthony Lewis, is it possible that through their actions, these men have, in fact, forfeited their American citizenship?
Oh, I suppose it's possible, but that forfeit could only follow a criminal trial. It can't be. I don't believe that the government would argue that the citizenship could be taken away without proof in an ordinary way that they had joined a foreign military force.
Emily Bazelon, what about this issue of citizenship this morning? Tony Lewis pointed out that Justice Ginsburg was not so concerned about that. She was looking at the fundamental questions of due process for all, perhaps citizen or not. But did the court seem to be interested in drawing a large distinction because these men had claims of U.S. citizenship?
I think that's going to be a tricky issue for the court. Do they really want this case to turn on citizenship, or do they want to embrace a kind of broader understanding of due process rights that include everyone?
So that's still open for us to see what comes out of the court. Nick is calling from Boston. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Yes.
And I guess the point that I want to emphasize is that in history we've heard a lot of assertions of crises in national security, certainly every bit during the communist era and the Cold War. We certainly could have argued for that in Timothy McVeigh and his, quote, domestic terrorist acts. But when it came, for example, to Watergate, our historic reliance on, take my word for it, when we were investigating some of President Nixon's actions, it's a national security issue, don't look behind it. It turned out that when the judicial process got involved, some of the allegations of national security really had no merit.
So even those, and are you willing to raise that argument even after seeing, like all of us, the Twin Towers in New York fall to the ground?
I think it is absolutely critical. I'm an attorney, but it's not even relevant. I think as a citizen, these issues are far too important to even let it be deemed a close question. I mean, we are not, as I've heard very well argued, we're not in a state of war with a broken judicial system that we are paralyzing our government's ability to defend itself. They can solve and balance off their intelligence needs without literally abrogating some of the most fundamental principles that we've created in this country to limit government.
Nick, stick with us for just a second. I want to put that to Andrew McCarthy. Andrew McCarthy, you've written for the National Review, very conservative magazine. I take it something from that about your political views. How does a conservative square this issue? Because, of course, the rights of individuals are paramount, not least, maybe most of all, to conservatives. On the other hand, there's a security threat here, but how do you balance these two?
Without security, there is no liberty. So that you're at a crossroads with all these difficult issues that arise out of the actions of the executive branch in wartime.
But I thought I thought there was never secure liberty, that it always had to be defended, that was part of the point. I mean, if you put security too high above liberty as a priority, doesn't it begin to squeeze liberty itself?
Well, of course it does, because they're forever in tension. The idea, and I think I don't want to get into liberals and conservatives. I think sensibly, we all have a different place, perhaps, where we come out on where this tension between order and liberty has to come out. But on either end of the extreme, where one vanquishes the other, you'll lose the one.
And to Nick's point, our caller, that we've seen as Americans in not so distant history, instances of the White House not being fully forthright and honest. So how should a citizen calibrate bring that into account when they see a fellow citizen detained indefinitely without charge? It's a tough call.
Well, I think that you need to look at all of the facts and circumstances. Here, you do see fellow citizens who are detained.
But we don't get to look at all the facts and circumstances. Isn't that the point?
Well, of course you don't. You also don't, realize that on the battlefield, the executive branch is actually killing some of the enemies.
Right, sure.
This is a lesser remedy, if you will, of what Congress has authorized the president to do. And frankly, to say that, we don't trust the president, I don't know where that gets you. The president has a full array of things that must be carried out in order to fight a war, which I don't think that anybody doubts sensibly that we're actually in.
But as the Justice just said, that's not without limit. Even the George Washington blessing is not without limit.
Yes, but what you're talking about now, I mean, we get back to abstraction versus reality.
Yep.
We're not talking about what conceivably is out there that the executive could do that would surpass the line that Justice Scalia was trying to find. What we're talking about is, in the here and now, is it okay to detain these two particular individuals?
Nick, we're talking about a dirty bomb here, a radioactive bomb, allegedly. You hear Andrew McCarthy's response. Does it satisfy you?
It really doesn't, because I think the only issue, he will prevail when he goes to a second party. A check and balance is always going to help and add credibility. This is not that if you involve the judicial system, the dirty bomb, the terrorist, the Timothy McVeighs will be given free rein. It's let's have a check and balance which will validate exactly their objectives. It's not a challenge. This isn't really a wartime situation in the U.S., any more than it was during the communist era.
Well, there's a big subject for debate in itself. But, Nick, thank you very much for your call. Anthony Lewis, I see you leaning in here.
You said a moment ago, Tom, we've seen some occasions when what the White House said was not perfectly accurate. Well, we've seen one in our history that was really a blot on our national history, and that was the removal of Japanese Americans from their homes on the West Coast in World War II and their confinement in desert camps. On the finding by President Roosevelt that they were a threat, that they might carry out sabotage or espionage. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, it was a finding completely blotted by racial prejudice of an extreme kind. There was no sabotage. There was no espionage. The Japanese Americans were extremely loyal, fought hard for the United States. In essence, we're being asked to trust people on things that you can't trust anyone, no matter how noble his intentions. I'd say we ought to do what President Reagan said about the Soviet Union, trust but verify. And the court system is the way we verify.
And let me just put it to you then, Anthony Lewis. On that point, if Jose Padilla allegedly was trying to engineer the release somehow of a dirty bomb, just let's imagine that the worst case here, that somehow, all of Chicago was radioactive, because it seems outsized, but who knows, because of the actions of this one man. If it were the case that trying to pull him through the criminal justice system made that attack more likely, are you still prepared to run that risk in the interest of civil liberties?
No, but I don't think I accept the premise, because I don't think it would make it more likely. If they actually had compelling evidence that he was about to do this, believe me, he wouldn't do it.
Mark is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. 2 points. One is that Hitler, when he was coming to power, realized that he could destroy – he first tried to destroy democracy from the outside and had his push and was put in jail, and then he realized he could destroy it from within. So the first point I would make is that those who do not believe in democracy, such as these terrorists, are very dangerous when you let them use the judicial system, because they frequently get off, such as the two individuals in Germany who the court themselves said are likely guilty of wanting to do terrorist acts, but they did not have evidence against them.
Just a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
That's right. And the second point is the point made by the head of Amnesty International, who said, we too frequently look to defend these individuals who desire to destroy our society and do not look at other tenets that we believe in, and that is the security of the of individuals to not have this type of harm, such as the World Trade Center, perpetrated against them. Those are my 2 points.
Mark, we've got it, and thank you for your call. And Andrew McCarthy, here's a sympathetic ear saying, give terrorists access to the court system, to the fruits of democracy, and they'll use it against democracy. But I guess that can cut two ways. Let me ask you, though, our time is very short here, just a couple minutes left. In a minute or so, Andrew, what are you expecting from the courts? How are you reading their questions today? Which way do you think they'll go?
I think what Emily said earlier is absolutely so. It's hard to say. I think, bottom line, I would be very surprised if the court did anything at this point in time during the midst of what's a very active war against a very powerful enemy who, even though it hasn't struck here since September 11th, has struck elsewhere with great force, that the court is unlikely to do anything that will disrupt the executive branch's ability to proceed with the war. That's not to say that they may not lay the groundwork for further scrutiny, particularly if we get to the point where the war is more technical and less active. But that's what I'd expect.
Anthony Lewis, your reading of this court on this time.
I can't give you a clear answer. I walked out of that hearing this morning saying it's too close to call, and I still feel the same way.
And to your recent column, do you still see an undermining of the very foundation of democracy at work in the Bush administration's pursuit of policy, particularly around the war on terror?
I do. I think that the assertion of a presidential power, unconfined by Congress, unconfined by the courts, to pick out any American citizen and say, you're an enemy combatant, you go to prison without a lawyer, in solitary confinement, no trial, no charge, you can be there forever. It's a power that I frankly couldn't have imagined it happening. And I think very few Americans, if they think about that in terms of it happening to them, you know, I don't think we'd accept that.
But here we are. Emily Bazelon, what's the calendar look like? When are we likely to have a decision from the court?
Oh, the court never tells you when it's going to come down with the decision, but it does tend to hold the hardest cases off until the very end of the term, so I would expect mid to late July.
We will be watching. Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Legal Affairs Magazine, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Andrew McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, frequent contributor to National Review Magazine, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Anthony Lewis, right here with me in the studio, longtime New York Times columnist, thanks for being here.
It was my pleasure.
This is On Point.